BOO Portland coming up next on One Land Many Voices. They will air the remarks delivered at the Realities of Jerusalem Today conference.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. The Cascade Festival of African Films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include Razzia, a film from Morocco, and more at the Hollywood Theater, and Wale from Burkina Faso, Fig Tree from Ethiopia, shorts from emerging African filmmakers, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104, at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the NAACP kickoff to Black History Month on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library in Vancouver, Washington. The NAACP kickoff to Black History Month features performances from African drummers, actors and storytellers, artist talks, a presentation by the Buffalo Soldiers of Fort Vancouver, and much more. Again, that's the NAACP kickoff to Black History on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library, 901 C Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 901 and it's time for One Land, Many Voices, followed at Valley Views and Flashpoints, and at 11 Pacific Underground. Let's get it on.
Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. Today on Arab Voices, I will be airing the remarks delivered at one of the panels held at the Houston-Jerusalem Conference on the topic, the realities of Jerusalem today. And in order to allow enough time for that, I will skip Arab Voices community calendar, but you can find a comprehensive list of upcoming events in the greater Houston area on our website, arabvoices.net. 3 months ago, on October 11th, 2018, the Jerusalem Conference was held right here in Houston. It was titled Jerusalem, What Makes for Peace? The conference was organized by Bright Stars of Bethlehem. It brought together scholars, ecumenical theologians, and peace doers to discuss and talk about the conference topic, Jerusalem, What Makes for Peace? There were several panels covering different topics at the conference, all centered on Jerusalem. One of those panels was on the topic, The Realities of Jerusalem Today. There were three speakers at that particular panel. Osama Qawasma, member of the Palestinian National Council; Tariq Abu Atta, executive director of Friends of Sabil North America, who previously worked as the coordinator of the Christian Peacemaker team in Hebron; and Majid Bamya, political coordinator and legal advisor for the permanent observer mission of the State of Palestine at the United Nations, and he is also the head of the International Law and Treaties Department at the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. That panel was moderated by John Lindner. I'm going to air now the remarks delivered at that panel, The Realities of Jerusalem Today, followed by some of the questions and answers that followed the remarks. So let's listen in. First, you will hear Osama Qawasma, followed by Tariq Abu Atta, and then Majid Bamya.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for allowing me to deliver this speech on behalf of our people in Palestine, the indigenous, who are suffering at the 21st century from all kinds of torture. I will try to use what I wrote, but maybe I will speak directly without anything. It's an honor to stand before you representing the oppressed, yet hopeful indigenous Palestinians who have been living along enough under unprecedented type of occupation and ethnic cleansing. For decades, Palestinian generation after generation sacrificed physically, emotionally, culturally, to maintain our identity as the indigenous people of Palestine. We continue to teach our children limitless love for life and unwavering determination that our rights are incapable of being alienated, surrendered, or transferred. Since al-Nakba, and with faith of humanity, Palestinians have called upon all peace-loving people of the world to stand tall along our side in our struggle and resistance against the colonization of our land, Palestine. We engage the international community in our pursuit of justice and defend numerous violent unsuccessful attempts to silence and or punish our voice. On the other hand, the Palestinians continue to seek peace in every possible venue, believing that enough is enough. Enough uprooting our people out of their country and homes and dreams, creating the worst refugees case in the history of mankind. Enough burning our powerless kids, Dawabshe and Abu Khdeir style. Enough imprisonment of 7,000 Palestinians in Israel in human jails with hundreds of women and children, part of them since 1978, about 40 years in the prison because they struggled for freedom and nothing more. Enough demolishing Palestinians' homes and properties in our occupied land, which recognized from the UN and the international law, and building settlements on an internationally recognized as an occupied land, Palestine. All of you know well that in 2012, Palestine recognized by 138 countries over all the world. 1967 is our border with East Jerusalem, and they are building settlements in this land and uprooting the people from Hebron, from Bethlehem, from East Jerusalem, from our cities, and obligating us and our children and women to leave their homes, their dreams, their heritage, and to go out. And we are at the 21st century, unfortunately. Ladies and gentlemen, all Israeli settlements in Palestine, including in and around Jerusalem, are illegal according to the international law. Again, and a major obstacle to achieve a long overdue peace, which is really now, it's like a dream in Palestine. Enough of the segregation wall that needlessly separated the Palestinian family, confiscated our land, and leave our people in South Africa racist apartheid style. And here I would like to clarify a point. The justification for Israeli government that the wall is to protect the Israelis. I don't to talk about the details, but if the security reason is the reason to protect the people, why you confiscated 17% of my land? Why you built it on my land if the security is the reason? The reason is the segregation and annexation and make our life miserable and to prevent any possibility to build or establish a state of Palestine. This is the reason. But the justifications is always ready on the table. While the Israeli right-wing government wastes no time or opportunity to recklessly destroy any and all chances of peace in the Middle East, we the Palestinians continue to believe that the world community should put an end to the Palestinian misery and allow Palestinians to live in peace in their independent state, Palestine, with Jerusalem as its capital. And there is no capital and no peace without Jerusalem, a capital of Palestine. This is our heritage. It's not like only stones and a place or land. It's the place where the Muslim and the Christians pray together. And I would like to remind all here that just last year, when they closed Al-Aqsa Mosque, our friends, the Christians, call us to pray in the churches, and we did it. And in opposite, when they imposed the tax on their churches, we opened our mosque to pray together, because we are together, Muslim and Christian, the indigenous of Palestine, and nobody can delete us. Israel will not be able to act like an outlaw state and continue with its crime, disregarding all international laws, including the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prevent them to uproot the people from their homes, from their lands, without unconditional and unlimited support, backing, and finance of the United States administration, unfortunately. Adding salt to injury, the current U.S. administration withdrew as a peace broker or mediator and aligned itself with Israeli side completely, 100%, starting with the unwarranted recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and moving its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, to our capital, and cutting its due to the UNRWA and to the Palestinian hospitals in East Jerusalem, and finally shutting down yesterday the PLO mission to the U.S. Why? We don't know. The side who are fully committed to the peace process is punished, while the side who is fully violating the international law is awarded. This is, I think, something very strange. The Israeli government reads the above as a green light and approval for further steps to extend its horrifying crimes and accelerate confiscation of further land. Point in case Al-Khan al-Ahmar. I just came recently from Al-Khan al-Ahmar. I spent more than 82 days there, days and nights. Just we went to Hebron to see our kids, our families, because we love our kids also and we love the life. And we teach the life to love the life. This is our dream. But Al-Khan al-Ahmar is the east gate of Jerusalem. And they want to uproot about 43 communities there to enforce the people to go out and demolish their land, their homes there, and to build settlements to prevent any possibility to have any connection between Southwest Bank and Northwest Bank. And this will be the last point in peace completely. They want only apartheid regime under the Israeli control. And ask him, what do you want? Do you want two-state solution or one-state solution? They will not answer you. Tell them what are your borders. They will not answer you. Finally, the demolition of Al Khan Al Ahmar will illegally change the geography and the demography of an occupied area with Israeli strategic goal, as I personally have witnessed separating the North West Bank from South, sealing the last nail in the two-state solution coffin, and consequently the failing peace process completely. A comprehensive just peace in the Middle East is the cornerstone to the world's stability and prosperity. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict never been a religious. We have no problem with Jew. We have no problem with any religion. Our problem with the occupier, it doesn't matter. He is Muslim, he is Christian, he is Jew, he is not believer, it doesn't matter. My problem is the occupier, with the oppressor, who want to obligate and impose on me an apartheid regime, and there is no conciliation with apartheid, with occupation. We are a human being and equally human being, and we deserve freedom, nothing more. Forever stand with the just and fight for a freedom and liberation of our land from the settlers and colonialists cannot possibly be called terrorists. Otherwise, the American people, in their struggle in liberation from the British colonists, would have been terrorists. Resistance against, the struggle of Asian, African, Latin American people would also have been terrorism. And many of the great leaders, which we're proud of in history, like Washington Lincoln, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Mandela, among would have been considered a terrorist. And this is not true. They are struggled for their people all. And we are following their steps to have our identity and freedom, nothing more. Finished. The Palestinian cause is a just and proper struggle consecrated by the United Nations Charter and by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The preamble to the United Nations Charter reads, "We, the people of the United Nations, are determined to save succeeding generation from scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of a human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small." Doesn't matter if we are small or not, we are a human being. "And to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. We are looking forward to hosting your next conference, hopefully in Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine. And after that, we will all visit our friends in Bethlehem to show you how we are living together, Muslims and the Christians, coexistence and together, and we don't need any more bloodshed. We want peace for you, for us, for our neighbors, for our children, for all. Thank you."
I usually do put on my cowboy boots, but I was sick in bed for 3 days. I could not put them on today. Sorry, folks. My biography is much simpler than what you have in your bulletins. It goes as follows. When I did failed negotiations work, they called me a professional peacemaker. When I did nonviolence organizing, they called me a Christian peacemaker. And when I asked why were my people being violent, they saw Jesus and called me a terrorist. You see, my theology is not very complicated, and our Palestinian story is not very complicated. Those in the pews of the Christian churches sometimes want to free themselves of the responsibility to do something about it, so they say it's complicated. Whose lands is this conference being held on today? 15 different indigenous tribes. How many are here today with us? That is my Palestinian story. You see, my story is not just my personal story. It is tied into my people, my people's oppression, Christian hegemony and dominance, white saviorism, Christian Zionism built on both. And it is a story of doing Palestinian liberation theology out of the cracks that want to grow that plant through the desert. And if we and you want to be Christian, we have to act up and not sit just at conferences, to go back to our churches and act up, flip the tables on injustices in our own churches. What is a white savior? A white savior is a white person that acts from their oppression to say, I know the truth, mistranslating Jesus' words of I am the truth to the church and Christianity, and how I practice my Christianity is the truth. That is what a white savior does and did in Palestine. How do we act it out in the Holy Land? We serve as missionaries. We conquer and save as opposed to solidarity with the indigenous peoples of the land. We do witness trips and pilgrimages that bypass speaking to Palestinians. Or maybe we'll speak to those who are like us, the Palestinian Christians, but ignore everybody else. And we center voices in Palestine that we want to hear and that feed into our already Christian Zionist theologies that we practice in our churches. What is Christian dominance and how does it tie into white saviorism? Christianity that is dominant and comes out of a white saviorism says, I will save you because I'm a virtuous, good Christian. And I will serve in your country as the Holy Land because you are uncivilized. I am civilized. I am us. You are the other. I am the way, the truth, and the light. There are the good Palestinians who are Christian, and there are the ones who are not, who are Muslim. There are the nonviolent, and there are the violent. That is what Christian dominance and tying into white saviorism does to my country. My 10-year-old self, Christian self in Palestine, wrote to me a letter the other day, and it said this. They didn't want to know me. In the shadows of the Holy Land, they rushed by my Christ to genuflect to their idols. And my people's wound was for them a showcase. For a pilgrim who is enamored by the churches of narcissists than by the streets of the divine. So don't mold me in your image, for I'm already molded in the image of God. And when white saviorism unites with Christian hegemony and dominance, that's when we have Christian Zionism, an exclusivism theology that talks about the modern state of Israel as if it were a biblical manifestation of the end times to come, where we Christians are saved, the rest convert, and then we know that we were all along the truth. So the Judeo-Christian alliance is a constructed reality, constructed with white Christians on top, Palestinian Muslims at the bottom. Race and discrimination are enlightened from that stratification. And the Muslims, they become heathens. But the ultimate shtick to this paradigm are the Palestinian Christians. Why? Because we belong to the land as well as the Muslims. So we become the heretical Jesus that is looking out and guarding the queer spaces of our own faith and theology that has been hijacked by Christian Zionism. I don't need you to post your flags on my grandmother's walls for you to claim your sin, because that is idolatry. What does all of this have to do with Jerusalem today, you might be asking? The Israelis are trying to separate the Christians from the Muslims and saying that the Christians are the more civilized, they should belong to the Israeli state. And hence, we can fully lift up this paradigm that we've been working with. And you see, Christian Zionism is the silence, not just the activism of our churches here, but it is the silence that is diffused in our Christian churches and theology today in mainline Christian churches. This is the theology that allows things like Osama was talking about that to go on without being questioned. You see, walls that stand between me and the other and the pure Israel nation in an ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem and Palestine are celebrated in a nation state law that says this is a nation state that is the home of the Jewish people. The right to exercise national self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people, and Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. So 2,000 years later, we can bring back Jews from anywhere around the world who have never been in Palestine, never had a history in Palestine, and say that they belong on this land. But my grandmother, who grew up in Haifa 70 years ago, is not allowed not only to live, but to visit Haifa. That is the theology we're operating with in this country, and with white saviorism and with Christian dominance. And then lastly, they say that settlements have a national value and the state will encourage and promote its establishment and consolidation against international law, which will be addressed in a minute. How long do I have?
Two more minutes.
I'll wrap it up with 2 more minutes. So what is the prophetic message of Palestinian liberation theology that we work from on the ground? We deal from politics from a faith perspective. We look at the political economic practices that contradict the purpose of God. Ecological abuse, human degradation, judging others for their sin and what they become rather than who they are. We ask what causes human hurt and what politics and economics bring hope to this hurt. We address the issue of God. We ask, what kind of a God do we believe in? A racist God who chooses one people over another, or a loving God of all people? What are these ideas of election, chosenness, exceptionalism, divine light that we still practice in our churches? Do Palestinians belong to that? Yes, we do. Palestinian prophetic liberation theology dismantles exclusivism and discloses an inclusive God for an inclusive people and an inclusive people of God. We judge asking which parts are contradictory to God and which parts are in line with God's purpose, and we pronounce hope in those places. And we articulate it with judgment and hope, with clarity and boldness, and we act. We act in intersectional theology, and we act in anti-imperialist theology that acts to flip the tables. The intersectional theology for me is very biblically centered. Who did God say was your neighbor? The Good Samaritan. That person you didn't want anything to do with. That is the theology I want to follow. So I welcome, to wrap it up, I welcome people coming and hoping in the Nativity Church, hoping through children's eyes. But we need you to come back here and act out your responsibility of making your churches justice churches and your denominations justice denominations. Not because we need to save the Palestinian Christians, not because we need to save the Palestinians, but because we need to save our churches and our own Christianity in this country. Amen.
So I called it Jerusalem, its fate, our fate. And when I speak of our fate, I don't mean the Palestinian people alone. The fate of Jerusalem will have its importance for the fate of all humanity. And forgive me, but you know, in your presence, there's a spiritual presence. So when we speak of Jerusalem, I'm starting with the celestial Jerusalem, close to the heavens. I know it's not the most traditional way of speaking of international law. But even international law and the UN had to adapt to the uniqueness of Jerusalem. And the UN recognized the specific status of the city, and it's called in resolution the holy city of Jerusalem, a sacred city for the 3 monotheistic religions, and also recognized the need to protect its unique spiritual, cultural, religious dimensions. The old city of Jerusalem and its walls are inscribed on the UNESCO World Heritage List and on the list of World Heritage in danger. The historical, cultural, and spiritual significance of Jerusalem was recognized and acknowledged as a microcosm of humanity's diversity. Is this particular status a blessing? Well, I'm sure that many would have a lot to say on why it is not, but let me say we believe it will be a blessing one day or the other. This uniqueness has found a translation in the partition plan with the idea of a corpus separatum, whereby Jerusalem would be under a special international regime administered by the UN. Today, that idea, this uniqueness, pleads for an open and shared city, where finally the land of the messengers will be able to embody the message. Jerusalem the terrestrial, with its many borders, walls, lines, demarcation, wars. We often say war and peace start in Jerusalem. We've experienced many wars. We still await to experience peace through Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been occupied, colonized, annexed. And since 1967, immediately the first settlers embarked on the hills of Jerusalem, surrounding the city first, and then after besieging it, attacking its heart. So now you have settlements, a ring of settlements all around Jerusalem, and you have settlements in the heart of Jerusalem, in Palestinian neighborhoods, in Silwan and in Sheikh Jarrah and Tur, and in the old city of Jerusalem. We have now 600,000 Israeli settlers, over 600,000 in the occupied Palestinian territory, including over 200,000 Israeli settlers in Jerusalem. And annexed, you had an Israeli law that came to try and put legislation on top of all these illegal practices, the basic law in 1980, which declared Jerusalem the unified and complete capital of Israel, and then we had the terminology of eternal capital of Israel. And of course, all of these actions have been deemed illegal by the Security Council, by the General Assembly, by treaty bodies, by the International Court of Justice. And the clearer the law, the clearer the violation. But Israeli practices defied the international law, and Israeli laws defied international laws, and Israeli courts defied international courts. And all of that would not have been possible if it wasn't for total impunity. The Security Council has not changed its position. Over all these years, decades, the position has remained that all these measures are null and void, and that Israel has to rescind them. Even under this administration, which tried to deny previous Security Council resolutions, 14 members of the Security Council opposed the American interpretation of the law, which is a quite absurd one. And then the General Assembly, by a very wide majority, stated that the recognition of Jerusalem in this manner and the transfer of the embassy were illegal, even though not mentioned explicitly. And there were 9 countries that opposed that view. So you know US and Israel, but you have also Micronesia, Marshall Islands, Palau, Nauru, Togo. So there were many countries to support the American position. And since then, many countries have followed suit with this administration and transferred their mission. Only Guatemala has done so, and even Paraguay, who had done so, reversed its decision. This is how solid the international consensus on Jerusalem is. Not only because it's grounded in international law, but because everybody understands the sensitivity and centrality of Jerusalem and how you need to address that if you want seriously to achieve peace, not talk about it and then destroy it. The wall that was deemed illegal by the International Court of Justice has separated 2 twin cities that remained together throughout history, despite successive conquerors. Jerusalem and Bethlehem have never been separated until this wall has been built. Discriminatory legislation, including absentee property law from 1950, allowed to take the property of the refugees and their land, and has been used in Jerusalem. Palestinians living in Jerusalem are considered permanent residents. And the term permanent is not very adequate because the objective of the Israeli laws and practices is to get out as many of them as possible. including through revoking the residency. 14,000 since 1967 have seen the residency revoked. Homes demolished because you don't allow Palestinians to be able to get permits and build. You allocate 13% of East Jerusalem, not all of Jerusalem, of East Jerusalem for Palestinians. All of it is already built up. And 35% for the expansion of settlers. 35% of East Jerusalem. And then you demolish the homes that the Palestinians built because they need a place to live. 2,000 homes have been destroyed since 1967. One third of all Palestinian homes in Jerusalem, one third, is at risk of demolition, with 100,000 Palestinians seeing the prospect and the risk of further displacement. This is the Jerusalem, the people that we talk about. This old man is maybe as old as the Nakba. And he has seen many armies pass in front of him. And he has remained steadfast on his land. And the Palestinians, refugees abroad, refugees within, Palestinians living in their land, continue to struggle to be able to live in freedom and dignity on their land. So here you can see West and East Jerusalem and the Green Line, which is the 1967 borders when we refer to it. Israel claims the city has been united by annexing the eastern part, but it has never been as divided. Because when you are united by oppression, denial of rights, discrimination, segregation, that is not unity. We believe unity comes when everybody is able to live in freedom and dignity and coexistence in the city, an open and shared city. And you can see in purple these settlements surrounding Jerusalem. What is in orange are Palestinian communities and neighborhoods in the city. So you see throughout them these settlements being built in order to move them out and separate them and cut off Jerusalem from the rest of its Palestinian environment. We also have these clear policies, displacement and replacement, confinement of Palestinians, expansion for the settlers. And looking at the ground, looking at these laws, looking at this lack of accountability, one might lose hope. But there is maybe a path to restore hope. The clarity of the law that has remained, reaffirmed by all the bodies that exist. We are celebrating 70 years of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the same year that the Palestinians endured the Nakba. All of this is denial of the human rights of Palestinians. Every fact-finding inquiry commission has reached the same conclusion. Every court on earth, everybody within the United Nations. Nothing Israel did was able to alter the law. Now we need to make sure it is enforced. You do not bend the law to accommodate the violation. You end the violation to uphold the law. There are fundamental principles in the UN Charter, among them the inadmissibility of the acquisition of land by force, one of the key cardinal principles of friendly relations among nations. You have the fundamental principle of the right to self-determination of people, including those under foreign occupation and colonial domination. What do? We apply this principle everywhere else, except for the Palestinian people. We tend to say that we've accompanied and struggled together with all those who fought for freedom, and we've seen them acquire their independence, become members of the United Nations. We've accompanied many of these nations till they were able to sit. We've seen the representative of apartheid South Africa being replaced by the representative of post-apartheid reconciled South Africa. We've seen things that many people thought impossible. We always thought we will be next. We're still waiting. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen. Many things that were impossible became possible, as Mandela liked to say. But the only way is not to count on the goodwill of the oppressor. That's not the way history works. It's not only dialogue. You know, you can always talk, but if there's no incentive to act differently. It was funny because it's the centennial of Mandela, and every country on earth came to speak of how it helped defeat apartheid. Every country. And they spoke of the measures they took, of the sanctions they took, of the solidarity they gave. Some of them quite late, some of them quite soon, some like you engaged from day one. Israel did not speak. It's complicated. They were the main ally of apartheid South Africa. I found it good that they didn't speak. It would have been worse if they had. But what I'm saying is, if it worked against apartheid, if it worked against colonialism, this idea of international involvement, of accountability, of solidarity, of course that is a path that will change how Israel acts and what the Palestinian people endure. Of course it will help us achieve peace for the benefit of all, Palestinians, Israelis, and the rest of the world. So there's an obligation to not recognize illegal actions, non-recognition, the contrary of recognition. When you recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, it's not a sovereign right. It is an illegal action under international law. There's an obligation not to recognize illegal actions. You can recognize a capital within the territory of a given state, not on the territory of another. You have an obligation not to render aid or assistance. That applies not only to governments. It applies to people and churches and entities and companies, not to render aid or assistance to settlements and their associated regime. An obligation to distinguish between the occupied territory and the rest. And you have an obligation to ensure accountability. When is the breaking point? What is the point beyond which we say we can no longer support that Israel? Some said, you know, when apartheid will be clearer. You know, we tend to see it quite clearly at this point. We don't know what others need. The Jewish nation state law is putting in the law these practices that you should be ashamed of. That is denying the rights of nations, promoting settlements and colonization. And I won't restate what was said about this law. So a de facto apartheid is becoming an apartheid by law. This is that Israel. It's not the only possible Israel. It's the Israel we arrive to with impunity. Why is there hope beyond that? Because of the strength of the spirit. We like to qualify ourselves as the guardians of the land. The Palestinian people, we've been there, we had the keys. We are the guardians of the land. But maybe we're the guardians of something even more important, the spirit of the land. La quintessence, quintessential part of its identity. What is the essence of this land? Diversity. The idea of a monopoly in Palestine, the idea of a monopoly anywhere, but Palestine. Palestine, you think you can exclude diversity from Palestine? And I speak here of historical Palestine, whatever state there will be at the end or there is. So we are the guardians of that identity, Palestinian Muslims, Christians, and Jews. There is no unified city by excluding people. So we say our fate is linked to the fate of Jerusalem. What Jerusalem and what world? Deciding what Jerusalem you have may be key in deciding what world you have. And honestly, I don't think that we want the Jerusalem we have today, nor do we want the world we have today. So we say, maybe we want a world where you don't attack judges to shield war criminals. Maybe that's not the kind of world we want to live in. Maybe we don't want to live in a world with double standards that erode the credibility and the protection of the law. We believe that peace requires justice. Justice requires enforcement. And that justice is the path to peace, not vengeance. We believe in coexistence, not apartheid. We believe in plurality, not monopoly, diversity, not exclusion, tolerance, not extremism, freedom, not oppression, equal dignity, not domination. Once we've stated these beliefs, we stated which Jerusalem we want, which Jerusalem the world needs.
Our framing questions for this panel include two specifics. What are the facts on the ground today and how of recent changes, what are the recent changes and their implications? Another topic that some of you touched on, Tarek and each of you really, is what has happened specifically for the Christian and Muslim communities in Jerusalem? How is the oppression, the tensions for them increased specifically in the last year since the Trump declaration? And what are the implications and concerns?
Yeah, I can start. And I think this whole, let's look at it in a much larger lens. A people without a land for a land without a people. That's the whole motto of Israeli Christian Jewish and Christian Zionism. So how do we now make a land without a people over the past 100 years? It is similar to our manifest destiny doctrines in this country. How do we put the indigenous peoples on reservations? So I was with the negotiation support unit in 2002 taking diplomats around when the wall was being built. I saw these communities firsthand that were left between, in the seam zone they call it, between what came to be the wall and de facto Israel. So these communities in that 12% of land that was confiscated were caged. Each community was caged, and you needed a permit to go inside not only Israel, but inside the Palestinian areas. What happens after every time 6 months getting a permit? The people transfer themselves, and they move to the Palestinian areas, and they create, Israel creates de facto reservations. So whether it's the north of Jerusalem, where the wall divides 30,000 Palestinians with Jerusalem IDs on the north, whether it is building a 30-foot concrete wall between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, whether it's the E1 plan, whether now Israel's talking and been talking about building an eastern wall, how do we uproot these communities and make a sliver of land into reservations? Where are these people going? They are either on reservations, and those who can immigrate are immigrating. So those of us who are Palestinian Christians sometimes have it easier in having connections with churches in the West or having families in the West, and so we immigrate. My family came here in 1989, and partly, not partly, it's due to the first uprising, the first Intifada. So what do these walls and cages and fences mean? These are just, I think Osama was talking about it, they are apartheid in action. We knew as children we were second-class citizens, but now the world is seeing it with his eyes through the hatred and apartheid and anger of the Israeli government that is concretized into concrete. That's what's happening on the ground.
You know, since Osama referenced the U.S. Constitution, I love our Declaration of Independence, but I like a quote from yours, which is, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." One has to decide if we believe these truths are self-evident for all, or only for certain categories. We always ask people to put themselves in our shoes, what it means to, you know, to be able not to access Jerusalem except if the Israelis want to give you a permit, when it is, for some of us, half an hour or an hour from our home or 10 minutes from where we are. What it means to go through military checkpoints to go from one Palestinian city to another. I'm an impatient man, and growing up, my worst experience was always waiting for hours on these checkpoints and then having this hassle with the young Israeli soldiers. What it means to have a settlement that reaches your home. We have homes in which settlers have taken certain rooms, and the Palestinian families are trying to keep the rest. We ask you, there was a Palestinian we went and met, and now his whole house is surrounded by the walls, so they've encaged him in his house and settlements around him. And we went and said, you know, we had some internationals with us, and they told him, why don't you try to find a home elsewhere? And he said, I have a house in the city, you know, 15 minutes away from here. And they were like, what are you doing here? He said, if I leave, they're going to take the house. This is the Palestinian people. This is this ability, this resilience is impressive. But put yourself in Israel's shoes. Why would you stop? So the idea was emptying the land. They're not going to go to that extent. Now it's maximum land, minimum people. So containment of Palestinians, confinement. expansion of settlers. Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank, Palestinians have built up 1% of that area. Israel has full control over that area. Its intention is never to give back what is ours. Its intention is to make it impossible for that area to come back. Mm-hmm. And I gave you the numbers for Jerusalem. Put yourself in Israel's shoes. What is the pressure you are feeling? You have international relations, you are engaged. Okay, you have condemnations from time to time, resolutions from time to time. And then put yourself in Israel's shoes when you have this U.S. administration. There was a time when this law that we spoke about, Israel would not have done it because it didn't feel the need to be so arrogant to the point of adopting a law on that issue. There are things now you feel even more emboldened to do. But you've already been emboldened by 7 decades of no consequences. No consequences. There's a lot of solidarity with the Palestinian people. But there is still a psychological barrier to take the necessary steps towards Israel. There is an Israeli exception. You know, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. always evoked this bias towards Israel. And she's completely right. There is an Israeli exception. It's not the number of condemnation. It's the fact that never followed by action. That's the real Israeli exception. Khan al-Ahmar is 180 people. 50% children. Almost all refugees facing the threat of being displaced again. The entire Israeli machine assaulting 180 people, including 50 children. The courts, the army, the political leadership, the legislators, all of it against this population. For me, the main question is, in the face of all this, this idea that we pursue the peaceful, legal, political path, the popular path, is a complicated idea. It's unbelievable that there are still demonstrations in Palestine. Mm-hmm. I've been in demonstrations, you get shot at. And you know that the person shooting at you will never face a consequence. I've been at demonstrations against settlements. Settlers can run you over. They know nothing will happen. Mm. It's crazy to still have faith that something is going to happen. But there's still faith. And maybe one day, again, I'm saying, we're still seeking where is that breaking point? Where is that moment when people say, that cannot continue that way? And I think Israel is betting that by the time that happens, it would have already implemented its plan and done its best to make them irreversible.
So we've begun to get questions from the audience, and quite an array of questions here. I think the first one I'll lead off with continues the conversation about international law, and it has to do with, why is the UN not able to enforce international law and 181 and 242 and various Geneva Conventions? Let's discuss for a minute the question of the ability of international law to be enforced.
The UN has the ability to enforce when it wants to enforce and when the big powers are in agreement to enforce. Having the main superpower as your shield is a very important factor in the inability of the UN to enforce in Palestine. We would be mistaken to say that the UN is paralyzed everywhere. It is the case of Palestine with this long, 7 decades long paralysis in enforcement is linked to that capacity. And it's funny because you have a permanent member of the Security Council, the United States. Everywhere else, they say Security Council resolutions are binding, they need to be implemented, if necessary, by force. I want to read a part of the resolution 478 because maybe, you know, it's complicated to read. You know, maybe it's hard. It's 1980. It says, calls upon those states that have established diplomatic missions at Jerusalem to withdraw such missions from the Holy City. I find it quite clear. I will not pretend that my English is as good as the people governing you, but, you know, the law is clear. It's a Security Council resolution. And when this principle was put to a vote, the U.S. vetoed it, but that doesn't cancel the fact that it's still the law, and the General Assembly adopted it, again, against the decision taken by the U.S. So it's either or. I think people should call it out. Either you say Security Council resolutions are binding and need to be enforced, and you're a permanent member of the Security Council. So the U.S. is ruining its own interests when it goes against the Security Council resolution. The U.S. counts on the respect that the Security Council has, and it undermines it for the benefit of Israel. The U.S. harms its own interests, for the interests not of the Israeli people, for the interests of the Israeli government. And you have this sentence, and I'll finish there, I know I'm being a bit long, but this unbelievable sentence that was told to us, everybody thought that things will go wrong if we move the embassy and recognize Jerusalem as capital of Israel. Nothing happened. They're right, nothing happened. 60 Palestinians were killed on that day. That is considered nothing. 60 Palestinians killed. Had there been an Israeli killed, something immensely wrong would have happened. Mm-hmm. What they're telling us is the only way for this to matter is for the Israelis to die, to be killed. And this is not the message we carry to our people. And this is not the beliefs that our people carry. People were demonstrating, they were shot at. Against that move, something went terribly wrong. Terribly wrong. And don't convince people that the only way to convince you of that is violence. And if they don't resort to violence, then it's okay, we can pursue on that path. So I think the signal is extremely worrying that we are in a time of blindness.
I just want to clarify one point quickly. In 1975, the war between America and Vietnam ended because you raised your voice loudly. Enough is enough. This was the main pressure. The universities, the churches, the faith, women and men said enough. We are both victims, and you recognize it and put an end. South Africa, also apartheid regime, collapsed. When here, the American moved and put pressure on their administration to put pressure on South Africa to put an end for this torture and apartheid regime. Unfortunately, here there is no a real pressure on the administration. And what Israel is doing is impossible. At this time we are here, we have 7,000 in the prison, there is bloodshed, their children sacrificed, there is everything against the international law, and they blame us. They took everything, even our heritage, and they blame us. So what we want from our friends, from our people here, Christians, Muslims, everyone who believe in justice, to stand tall with us. This is the time. Enough is enough. We want to live in prosperity, justice, equality, dignity. This is what we are about.
I just want to briefly comment for 30 seconds.
Sure.
To bring it back home, and I'm not going to go into the international law. I gave up on it as soon as I graduated from law school. But to say about the selectivity of applicability of the law is not just in Palestine, Israel. It is in this country. Have we seen those black children out on our streets in the U.S. being shot and the officers being let go and free? Have we seen these persons of color who are put on the stands and are convicted? And how much of a larger percentage they are convicted with. So the applicability of the law applies here domestically as well. And that's why we keep saying these are the same systems of power that keep communities of color down, whether here or whether in Palestine or whether across the world.
Amen. What you just heard were the remarks of Osama Qawasma, member of the Palestinian National Council, Tariq Abu Atta, executive director of Friends of Sabil North America, and Majid Bamya, political coordinator and legal advisor for the permanent observer mission of the State of Palestine to the United Nations. Those remarks were on the topic, the realities of Jerusalem today. Followed by some questions and answers, they delivered these remarks at the Jerusalem Conference held in Houston on October 11, 2018, organized by Bright Stars of Bethlehem. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. People of Earth is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on Earth.
And that was Arab Voices. That's the January 9th, 2019 broadcast. originally aired on KPFT in Houston. It's a Pacifica station. We thank them for sharing that with us. And we thank you. Well, we thank all the members of the KBOO Foundation for your support. We thank the passive listeners for tuning in. And we invite you all to become active members, like your friends and neighbors already have. Coming up, we're going to hear from Valley Views with your host Dale Holliday, coming at you from Corvallis, Oregon, in the bountiful Willamette Valley. This week, they're giving us a window into life as a campaign manager for a local grassroots bid for public office. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Again, hearing again from another arm of the Pacifica Network. That's from KPFA in Berkeley. At 11 on Pacific Underground, Jake and Sarah join in Korean. They join Korean Canadian poet Emily Youngmin Yoon. Boy, I hope I said that correctly. To talk about her debut full-length poetry collection. We hope you will join your friends and neighbors and other persons and entities in your community in supporting the work of KBOO Portland, such as one I'm about to tell you about, which is my honor, privilege, and contractual obligation. This is the time when I remind you that KBOO programming comes from support for KBOO programming comes from Dark Side Cinema in Corvallis. Open every night featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson. More information and showtimes available online at darksidecinema.com.